furious with me. He had twice before refused to negotiate for Diotima. By Athenian law, he had every right to refuse, and as long as he did, by Athenian law, the marriage had never happened. My girl had always been known as Diotima of Mantinea, the town of her mother's birth, rather than by the name of her father, because she was the illegitimate child of a prostitute by a prominent citizen. Diotima had risen to become a priestess of Artemis, but the miasma of illegitimacy still clung to her. That had changed when Diotima's mother finally married, not Diotima's father, who had died, but a newly made citizen, the barbarian Pythax. Pythax was, if possible, even more angry with me for marrying Diotima than my own father was. He'd become responsible for Diotima the moment he married her mother. Now, he faced the prospect of a daughter for whom he could never hope to find a good husband, because I had, in his words, soiled the love of my life. No Athenian father would accept Diotima as wife for his son in her new and entirely irreversible condition. Now, she sat in a tent, waiting to learn her fate while our fathers squabbled. Diotima balanced a knife on one finger and said, "Would you believe Pythax, father, took away my bow and quiver?"
"I should hope so. The sacred truce forbids arms at the games."
"I don't even have my mother here to talk to, and, oh gods, how desperate do I have to be to have said that?" Diotima grimaced. She and her mother were not exactly close friends.
"I think I can relieve the boredom for you."
I told Diotima how Timodemus had broken his oath, and the fallout from it, finishing, "No one knows what's to happen. Timodemus may or may not be banned."
"Interesting."
Diotima had paid close attention to my story. I knew if I asked her, she could repeat everything I'd said almost verbatim.
"Why did your friend attack the Spartan?"
"He wouldn't tell me."
"That's worrying."
"It's irrelevant, unless they let him back in."
"It's certainly irrelevant to me while I'm stuck in this tent."
"What happened with Pythax?" I asked her. After we'd arrived and my father had disowned the marriage, Pythax had taken control of Diotima and rented this tent to install her. Diotima shrugged unhappily.
"Pythax says I'm not to leave the camp without a responsible adult, by which he meant himself.
I'm not sure it means you."
"Oh, I thought about taking you to visit the Agora." She pushed herself off the travel chest.
"Good, let's go."
"You just said your stepfather wouldn't allow it."
"Yes, he will. Pythax is desperate to win me over, and besides, he isn't all that bad, you know. Beneath that callous, gruff exterior, there's
She was lost for words. "A callous, gruff interior?"
"Well, all right, yes. But he's besotted with my mother, and if he wants me to call him Daddy, he'd better not stop me."
I wondered if Pythax had met his match in his new stepdaughter, and what that might mean for me, and whether there was something I should do about it. But I wasn't about to stand in the middle of any fight between Pythax and Diotima. There are easier ways to die. I led her across the ford, and we walked through the sanctuary of Zeus and out the other side to see the famous festival Agora of Olympia, which for 49 months out of 50 is an empty field of weeds, and for the remaining 1 month is the most exciting place in Hellas. The festival Agora lies to the north of the sports grounds, on the east side of Mount Kronos, where the market catches the sun in the morning. We heard the sound of the people before we saw the market itself, just around the bend.
"Yah!"
A man in a lion's skin jumped out in front of us. He swung a gnarled club at our heads. Diotima and I leaned back instinctively. The madman missed us by a wide margin. I stepped forward into the swing, hooked my leg behind our assailants, and pushed him to the ground. I snatched the club from his hands as he fell.
"What do you think you're doing?"
I shouted at him. He picked himself up. I expected another attack and gripped the club in both hands to use on its owner. But when he only stood there, head hung low, I asked,
"Who in Hades are you?"
"I'm Heracles," he said.
"Wasn't Heracles larger and..." I looked him up and down.
"Slightly better muscled?"
The man before us was dark-haired, small, and weedy. A faded and somewhat patchy lion skin draped over his left shoulder fitted him like a tent. Now that he no longer swung the club, I saw he had the muscle tone of a dead chicken. The weedy character said,
"You've never heard of the Heracles imitators?"
Diotima and I both shook our heads.
"Milo of Croton did it first. Men at the games have been dressed as Heracles ever since. We do it for fun. Play-acting, you know. And to impress the crowd."
"Who's Milo of Croton?"
Diotima asked.
"He was the strongest man who ever lived, barring Heracles himself. You've never heard of Milo?"
said the fake Heracles.
"This is our first Olympics," I said. "This is my fifth,"
he smiled. He'd scored a point over us.
"I'm from Ellis. I come to every games."
I inspected the club. It really was a solid piece of twisted wood. I handed it back.
"You should be careful with that. You might hurt someone."
The club hung limply from his hands.
"It's just a game. I'll be more careful. So, what do you think of the Festival Agora?"
"I don't know," said Diotima. "You're standing in my way."
"Oh, sorry."
Fake Heracles stepped back to reveal a vista of the festival ground of Olympia. Men and women in gaudy festival clothes moved like a flowing rainbow among the stalls and displays. Jugglers wandered among the crowd, tossing and catching balls with blinding speed. Flute girls swayed and played their lilting tunes.
"Oh, Nico," Diotima breathed. She took my hand and stepped into the swirling crowd. We wandered from stall to stall. Vendors had come from all over Hellas to sell every imaginable thing. Fine jewelry, beautiful cloths of many colors and patterns, bronzeware that shone in the sun, plus fine food. A man stirred a large kettle of sizzling spiced lentils. His wife handed out steaming bowls to those with coin. Every second stall sold wine. I bought silver earrings for Diotima because they matched her headband, and a bronze mirror because I knew she didn't have one with her. The earrings were in the shape of bears, the animal sacred to the goddess Artemis, whom my Diotima serves as priestess. We came across three more Heracleses. One of them lifted a vast block of stone, his every muscle straining to burst through his skin, before he tossed it over his shoulder to the applause of the onlookers. "This is what I imagine it must be like every day for the gods on Mount Olympus," Diotima said. "Can you imagine walking through such a crowd and coming face to face with a goddess?"
"I already have," I told her, and she blushed. Naked acrobats tumbled and somersaulted past us. I put my arm around Diotima's waist and squeezed tight. It wouldn't have been proper to kiss my wife in full public view, but the temptation was almost overwhelming.
"Why don't we go back to your tent for some tumbling of our own?"
I whispered into her ear.
"What will you do if Pythax catches us? He's already furious with you."
I'll point out, you can only break a pot once, I told her.
Diotima smiled, but she hesitated. I'd love to, Nico, but let's use your tent. I wouldn't want the other women to think you were accustomed... not my...
Diotima had a horror of anything that could possibly be misconstrued to suggest she was a professional woman, as her mother had once been. Her background, paradoxically, had made her more prim and proper than the most natural-born of citizen women. I said, "Wouldn't it look even worse if you were seen walking into a tent in the men's camp?"
"Men don't notice. The women have nothing better to do than spy on one another and gossip."
When we returned to my tent, a message awaited me, scrawled untidily into a wax tablet and left to lie on the ground. It read, "Pericles says this to Nikolaos. Timodemus has been reinstated. The Spartans are furious. Keep a close eye on your friend." Diotima had rested her chin on my arm and read along with me. "I'll have to go at once," I sighed.
"How long do you think this tablet has been here?" Diotima asked.
"Could be as long as half the afternoon."
"Then he can wait a little longer," said Diotima. She pressed her body against me, put her arms about my neck, and raised her face to be kissed.
I was instantly aroused. I pulled the shoulder pins from her dress, and it fell to the floor. "Now, Timo, do you promise me you'll go into that tent and not come out until morning?" Timo laughed.
"What are you, Nico, my mother?"
A mother wouldn't have trailed as close to Timodemus as I had that afternoon. I'd caught up with him at the gym where he was being congratulated by friends. The friends had been strangely absent in the morning when Timo was in trouble, but were exceedingly visible after the judges announced his rehabilitation. Man after man said that Timo was sure to win, for he must have the favor of the gods, and all of Athens was behind him. I knew how uncomfortable such talk made him feel. I waved from the back of the crowd and said in a loud voice that Timo was wanted at the Bulletarian. Timo edged away, and we made our escape. When we were out of sight, we diverted to the Agora, where I bought a few wineskins to celebrate, and we found a quiet spot by the river. We were both in a more relaxed state than we had been in the morning. We stayed there until it was well and truly dark, after which we meandered back to the campsite. An athlete needs his sleep. When we came to Timo's tent, I insisted he stay there and not go wandering about. "I promised Pericles I'd keep an eye on you. I can't do that if you go partying across Olympia in the middle of the night. What if some Spartan tries to get revenge?"
"You are protecting me?"
Timodemus was too polite to point out that he had beaten me to a pulp that morning. Instead, his eyes lingered on my bruised neck and my aching knee. Diotima had wrapped a wet rag around it to reduce the swelling, and he smiled.
"I thought you were sticking with me to make sure I didn't do anything stupid again."
"Perhaps a little of both," I conceded. "I know you could destroy me with your little finger, Timo, but has it occurred to you that even the weakest man could knife you as you sleep, or attack you from behind as you walk through the crowds?
I can watch your back.
Pericles said he spent political capital on you, and he doesn't like his property damaged."
Timodemus laughed. "All right, Nico, I'll stay in the tent."
"Promise?"
"I promise." "Good night, then."
Timodemus stepped into his tent and closed the flap. I settled down outside and listened to the night. All over Olympia, men partied. Bonfires lit up the night in every direction. Sweet smoke drifted in the light breeze.
Men sang. Women laughed. Somewhere close by, music played, growing louder. A Comos line appeared, happy, shouting men and intoxicated women. Olos players danced alongside and fingered their V-shaped flutes with both hands. The revelers kicked in time to the music and snaked their way down the street. They waved at me to join them, one a lovely red-headed woman, but I shook my head and smiled. The line passed around the corner and out of the camp, leaving me alone once more. I was missing the biggest party in the world, all because my best friend couldn't be trusted not to strangle people. I hoped my sacrifice was worth it. I made a mental note to remind Timodemus of this every day for the rest of his life. What was Diotima doing while I sat here in the dark? She was probably stuck in her tent, reading a scroll or throwing knives or... A sudden thought struck me, and my breath tightened. Maybe she'd met some handsome man and gone off to a party. Diotima liked men's chests. It was a particular thing for her, and this was the sort of place where she'd see plenty of them. I put my hands under my eczemas and checked my chest. I had to admit, there were men with broader, better-muscled chests, especially around here. Maybe I should ask Timo's coach, Dromius, for some exercises to make my own chest more manly. But that would have to wait until tomorrow. It was getting late. Even the parties in the distance had quietened as the drunks fell by the wayside. I yawned and lay back to relax.
"Are you all right?"
a voice said in my ear. I sat bolt upright. A man stood beside me. It was Festianos, Timo's uncle. His cheeks were flushed enough that it showed in the bright moonlight. A garland of flowers sat askew atop his thinning hair.
"Oh, it's you,"
he said when he recognized me.
"You're Timo's friend, aren't you? I thought you must be a drunk who'd passed out beside our tents. You were asleep."
"I wasn't asleep. I merely rested my eyes." Festianos laughed.
"Then you're one of the few men who snores when he's awake."
"I never snore." But Festianos had worried me. I lifted Timo's tent flap quietly to peer inside. There was Timodemus on his camp bed. The blanket that covered him rose and fell softly. I let the flap fall back.
"It's good news about the lad, isn't it?"
Festianos said.
"Yes, it is. We're very proud of him, my brother and I."
I yawned. I couldn't stop myself.
"Why don't you go get some sleep?"
Festianos said. "I have to keep an eye on Timodemus."
"I can do that. Old men like me don't need as much sleep as you young ones."
I hesitated. My head ached. My eyes felt like someone had rubbed grit in them. I could indeed use some sleep. And wouldn't I be a better guard for Timodemus in the morning if I was rested? He was safe enough with his uncle. "I'll do that. Thanks, Festianos." I left him sitting outside their tents with his head back, the garland circlet crooked on his head, watching the moon and stars. I staggered into the small tent I shared with my brother Socrates. Our father snored in an even smaller one beside us. Socrates was already asleep. It was chilly. I pulled my traveling cloak over me and edged close enough to my brother to steal some of his warmth. I was so tired I don't remember falling asleep.
"Wake up! Wake up, Nico!"
That was Socrates, his voice anxious.
"What?"
I rolled over.
"Go to sleep, Socrates."
"Get up!"
Someone swore mightily and kicked me in the back. Hard. Not Socrates. I sat
bolt upright while my hand scrabbled around for a knife it couldn't find.
"Who is it?"
My eyes focused. Two men stood in our tent. Both wore light armor, but held no weapons in hand. The one leaned over me, and I wished he hadn't because he'd been eating garlic.
"Get up! You're wanted!"
I struggled not to gag.
"By whom?"
I expected him to say Pericles.
"Timodemus asked for you. Better hurry if you want to be there for the death."
I moved. I grabbed my eximus and pulled it over my head as we marched. The almost full moon was high, the sky cloudless. It was easy to step among the tents and equipment left lying on the ground. A few men were still awake, clustered around fires, drinking, talking, singing, and arguing. They watched us pass, the two guards and me, with Socrates trailing behind. I let him come. There wasn't time to stop to argue with him. To my surprise, we left the Athenian camp all together and followed the path that snaked past the camp of the Spartans, and I choked with fear. Had they dragged Timodemus within? Apparently not, because we hurried by the entrance without pause. The sacred truce meant even mortal enemies could pitch their tents side by side in perfect safety, but still the Spartans arranged their own tents in regular clusters, and they left nothing loose on the ground for men to trip over if there were a sudden call to arms. I suppose they knew no other way. The guards led me to the river Cladius, which flows north to south along the western edge of Olympia. We crossed the ford without a word to the sentries, who in silence watched us pass by. The water was chilled and moved with relative speed, enough that a hurrying man might slip, but the people of Elis had long ago placed strong stepping stones. It was easy to cross with only damp feet. The path on the other side forked. To the left was the women's camp. To the right, a forest that had been there in the days of Heracles. We went right. I could see our destination now. A group of men clustered among the trees, easy to spot because two or three carried torches despite the moonlight. I discerned a lump on the ground. The lump became a man, the man a body, lying all too still. A body large enough to look like a mound. A man with his back to us turned as we stepped into what I now realized was a small clearing.
"You're too late," said the chief judge of the games. "Arachos has died."
The flicker of the torchlight across his face made the chief judge look like one of the Furies, and he was approximately as angry. He held in his right hand the badge of his office, a long staff which forked into a Y, and this he stamped into the ground.
"Who are you?"
he demanded of me. "I'm Nikolaos, son of Sophroniscus of Athens," I said.
"This is the man Timodemus requested, Exelon," said one of the guards. "You said to bring him."
"Oh, so I did."
Exelon, the chief judge, studied me for a long moment.
"You're a young man. Why?"
"I'm sorry, sir. I'll grow out of it."
"I mean, why did Timodemus call for you? Why not a responsible older man?"
"Is Timodemus also dead, sir?" I asked, anxious for my friend. "Is he hurt? Where is he?" I looked around. I counted at least 13 men within the clearing, in various states of visibility, depending on their proximity to the torches and their obscurity behind the thick vegetation. The moon was bright above us, so that the clearing itself was well lit,
yet the coverage of leaves upon the surrounding trees was such that, in some parts of the perimeter, I couldn't see if anyone was there. The body lay in one of those shadows. The chief judge of the game said,
"You are here at the request of the accused. It seems only fair to give him a chance to explain, if he can."
"Timodemus is accused?" At that moment, Pericles bustled into the clearing, accompanied by One Eye, and I breathed a sigh of relief. I agreed with Exelon, the chief judge, on one point. This was no place for a young man to represent Athens.
"One Eye's told me what happened." The usually elegant Pericles was unkempt by his high standards. His hair was uncombed. He wore no himadion. Pericles owned one made of the finest Milesian wool, and he normally would not be seen dead out of doors without it. He did wear a formal chiton, but it was smudged and crumpled. Was it possible that Pericles, like any normal man, dropped his clothes on the floor when he went to bed? He'd forgotten to put on sandals. Exelon banged his forked staff on the ground again and said,
"I blame Athens for this disaster, Pericles. Your man attacked Arachos this morning, and now Arachos is murdered."
"A scuffle in the morning does not necessarily mean murder in the evening," Pericles said.
"There's more," said the chief judge.
He moved a step to the side. Over the shoulder of the judge I saw Timodemus with his head bowed, and a guard to either side of him. The guards held his arms tight. It was the second relief for me for that night. I'd been afraid that Timodemus, too, lay dead or dying. Timodemus looked up at that moment, and our eyes met. His were unreadable. The expression on his face was identical to the one he wore in the Pancration, the same expression I'd seen right before we'd fought that very morning. Pericles said,
"What do you have to say about this, Timodemus?"
"There's nothing I can say," Timodemus said. "I didn't kill him. I haven't even seen Arachos since this morning."
I said to the chief judge, "Did you find Timodemus here?"
"Close by, in the women's camp, hiding."
"Hiding?" That didn't sound like Timodemus.
"Guards found him in the tent of Clymene, the high priestess of Demeter," the chief judge said grimly.
The priestess of Demeter was an integral part of the sacred games. The contests could not be held without her. If Timodemus had hurt or polluted the priestess by his presence, then the games would be delayed, and 10,000 angry sports fans would butcher Timo before the day was out. I decided not to ask the obvious question.
"What he was doing in the women's camp is irrelevant," said Exelon.
The chief judge seemed equally reluctant to follow that line of thought.
"The fact is, the women's camp is the shortest of runs from where we stand, and that is meaningful in the extreme."
"The implication is obvious," Pericles said. "But that's all it is. An implication. How many other men were in the women's camp tonight? Hundreds, at least. Probably thousands. No court would convict a man for that."
"You're not in Athens now, with your courts and your rhetorical tricks," said Exelon. "This is Olympia, where the 10 judges decide. It's in our power to ban Athens from the next Olympics."
Pericles said at once, "I apologize, Exelon. I didn't mean to imply otherwise." Pericles, contrite, was a sight to behold, but not at the cost of Timodemus, which was the way this was headed. Something had to be done. I asked,
"How did Arakos die?"
"See for yourself."
The chief judge stepped back to let me pass. The body lay in half-darkness. I knelt down. It was impossible to see detail.
"Can I have some light here?"
One of the torchbearers stepped over beside me, and suddenly the scene was revealed. The flame was fresh and still smoked considerably, and burned with a strong yellow light that was hot and eerie in how it revealed the ghastly corpse. Arakos had been laid out straight, a scarlet cloak placed under his head. It was the standard-issue cloak beloved of the Spartans. Blood had dribbled from his crushed nose and mouth, and now dried on his cheek. His jaw hung slack, and there were bloody gaps where teeth had been. But the worst was his eyes had been gouged out, both of them. The sockets were bloody holes. I looked behind me at once to where Socrates stood. He'd never seen violent death before. Well, now he had. I worried what effect the ugly sight had on my little brother.
"What happened to his eyes?"
Socrates asked in the same casually clinical tone he used for all his questions. So much for worrying about my little brother's mental health. But it was a good question. Where were Arakos's eyes? Something small and sharp jabbed under my knee. There were some front teeth and a small pool of blood. But not enough teeth. I opened his mouth and felt about inside with a finger. Yes, I felt a few more teeth lying loose. Whoever had hit Arakos had done a thorough job.
"Who found him?"
A man stepped forward.
"I did."
He spoke with a Spartan accent.
"Terrific."
"What were you doing in these woods so late at night?"
Another man had stepped forward and said, "I was with him."
He took hold of the first man's hand.
Right. Nice night for a walk, I guess. Is this how you found him?" "No, he was alive. We tried to save him."
"How did he lie?"
"Curled in on himself, knees drawn up, arms wrapped about his torso, face down in the dirt."
It was the position of a man being beaten who has no way to fight back. Arakos couldn't fight back? I inspected his wrists and his ankles. There were no tie marks, no indents into the skin that might have been caused by the pressure of a tight thong. His arms and legs were also clear of all but the bruises any fighter carries. There was a large clot of blood in his hair. I pressed on it. Gently at first, then harder. The scalp and the bone beneath moved inward under the pressure. In fact, it wobbled. This was probably what had killed him. I asked the group in general,
"Did Arakos say anything before he died?"
"He was unconscious most of the time."
A man in the outer shadows spoke up.
"He breathed in a real funny way. Really labored, you know? And he blew bubbles of blood."
Everyone knew what that meant. Arakos had been struck in the chest, and the ribs had pierced his lungs. I lifted his chitin and probed. There were no open wounds, but there was movement beneath the skin where there should not have been. By all appearances, Arakos, one of the finest bare-handed fighters in all Hellas, had been beaten to death. I stood up and dusted off my knees.
"This is impossible,"
the man who stood next to the chief judge said.
"It seems obvious enough to me. The Athenians surprised Arakos, perhaps in an ambush, and hit him from behind. There are many trees and other places from which to leap. He knocked out Arakos with the first blow, and then proceeded to beat an unconscious man to death.
The man who spoke was middle-aged, perhaps 15 years older than me, but his shoulders were broad, and he looked fit. He had a rich, dark beard and black, curly hair that was well kept. He stood straight and wore a cloak of the deepest scarlet. I said to him, "With no weapon, not even a knife? Why wouldn't the killer wait until Arakos had passed and stab him in the back?"
"It wouldn't be the first time things didn't go to plan in an ambush," he replied.
"Especially in a night attack."
"In my experience, it's unlikely," I said, doing my best for Timodemus. "And I have some expertise in these matters. I've examined more than one crime scene." He said, "In my judgment, it makes perfect sense, and I know something about ambushes."
"Who are you to be making judgments?" I demanded. He said mildly,
"I am Pleistarchus, son of Leonidas of Sparta." My stomach lurched. Dear gods, I had challenged a king of Sparta, one of the most powerful men in Hellas. This man's father was the Leonidas who had led the 300 at Thermopylae and died the most revered warrior of our times. With a word, Pleistarchus could have an army of Spartans at his back. There was one available in their camp, and the dead man before us was one of his own. I swallowed. "I'm sorry, King Pleistarchus," I said, as apologetic as I could be. "I didn't recognize you, but I don't think your idea can be right."
"Why not?"
He didn't seem offended. I touched the body's head. "See this wound? It's toward the front, almost on the forehead, and slightly on the left-hand side. This wound could not have been made from behind. It was almost certainly made by a right-handed man from in front." King Pleistarchus leaned over and examined the body with an air of genuine curiosity.
"You're right. Is there any wound behind?"
I was already running my hands around the back of the head. "Nothing there."
"What of his back?"
Pleistarchus waved to two soldiers, who together rolled over the heavy, awkward corpse. We all three felt about. "Nothing. No wounds. In the combined torchlight and strong moonlight, we could see bruises, but with death, there would be bruising in any case." Another Spartan stepped forward.
"Pleistarchus, I remind you this man who examines the body of our comrade is an Athenian. He will say or do anything to get another Athenian off the charge."
The man spoke as if to a difficult and slow child. I waited for the king of Sparta to explode, but all he said was,
"I know this, Zanares. Trust me, I will keep it in mind."
The man named Zanares was dressed in the style of formal chiton that covered him from neck to ankles in one long, flowing robe. He had a small, pinched mouth that looked like it was set in a permanent expression of distaste. Or perhaps it was the cares of office, for he seemed to be an official of some sort. He turned to one of the Spartan soldiers and said,
"Send for Marcos."
The soldier scampered off as if he'd received a command from Zeus.
"This whole question of the guilt of Timodemus can be put away at once," Pericles declared. "Nikolaos has watched over Timodemus like a hungry eagle every moment since he was reinstated to the competition. He can certainly swear that Timodemus was nowhere near Arakos."
Every eye turned to me. Suddenly, I was very nervous. I felt myself blush.
Pericles, that might not be entirely true.
I had to admit it,
There might be a witness to prove otherwise if I lied. After Timodemus went to bed, I handed over the watch to someone else.
What?
Pericles fairly screeched. Well, Timodemus was asleep. It wasn't like there was much to do, and it was someone reliable, I said in my defense. His uncle, Festianos.
So reliable we found the killer in the women's camp,
Xenares pointed out. Pericles turned to me and said, Watching like a hungry eagle, were you? His voice dripped with sarcasm. Pericles was being grossly unfair, but nor could I provide Timo with an alibi, so I obviously hadn't been watching him closely enough. Pericles had spent his precious political capital for nothing, and it was I who had advised him to do so. I had no choice but to accept his withering stare.
Where is this uncle now?
Exelon, the chief judge, asked.
Asleep before our tents, said One Eye, his first contribution. Chief Judge, I swear before Zeus my son had nothing to do with this. You mustn't let this incident interfere with the games.
I think my jaw hit the dirt. The chief judge stared at One Eye as if he were some strange creature suddenly in our midst, and so did everyone else.
Interfere with the games? Incident? The chief judge repeated in shock. One Eye, do you understand what's at stake here? Is Timodemus permitted to compete in the Pancration on the fourth day?
One Eye asked. How could he ask about such a thing with the life of his son forfeit?
A man with blood guilt upon him. Not only that, an oath-breaker before Zeus, Hercios. Don't be ridiculous.
The chief judge stamped his staff hard upon the earth.
This is terrible.
One Eye wailed. The death of a man didn't affect him. The thought of sacrilege at the sacred games moved him not at all. But the thought of his son unable to compete caused him to cry. Everyone stood speechless, embarrassed by his behavior.
You're looking for a friend of the dead man,
said Socrates into the suddenly frosty silence. I'd forgotten he was even there.
Be quiet, Socrates. This is a business for men.
Who is this boy?
Said the chief judge.
What is he doing here? Is this disaster some sort of show for children?
He's my little brother. I'm sorry, he was in the tent when your men came to fetch me. I'll send him home at once. Socrates, disappear!
Pleistarchus raised his hand.
No. Let the boy speak.
Very well. What do you mean, Socrates?
I demanded.
You said it yourself, Nico. The dead man was attacked from the front.
So? Socrates looked at us quizzically.
It's just that if you met a man in the woods at night and if he'd attacked you that same day, would you stand still to be hit again? It doesn't seem likely, does it?
I was about to say the same thing, I lied. Your brother makes a good point, said Pleistarchus. If Arachos had seen Timodemus, he would certainly have expected another attack. He would have been ready to defend himself.
Yes, it's very confusing, isn't it?
Socrates shrugged.
Because on the face of it, only Timodemus could have killed Arachos.
Whose side are you on here? I demanded. Socrates looked puzzled.
But, Nico, isn't the idea to work out the truth?
I ground my teeth and managed not to shout at him.
"Sorry, Nico," he said meekly.
"The boy makes sense again," said Pleistarchus. "The only man ever to best Arachos in the Pancration was Timodemus of Athens. Who else could have taken him on without a weapon and killed him?"
Unfortunately, the king of Sparta was right. What Socrates said made sense.
"Would you all excuse me for a moment?"
I marched over to Timodemus, grabbed him by the arm. The guards watched me drag him out of their earshot.
"Did you kill him?"
I hissed in the lowest voice.
"Nico,"
he said, obviously hurt.
"How can you ask such a thing?"
"I'm asking," I said through gritted teeth, "because when I defend you, I need to know what I have to deal with. Are they going to find any evidence against you? Tell me true, Timo, and swear by Zeus."
"I didn't kill Arachos. I swear this by Zeus. May he destroy me if I lie."
"All right." I let go of his arm and walked back to the body, stood over it, turned around. I wanted to see what Arachos saw the moment before he was attacked. Another man strode into the clearing. He pushed his way into the inner ring. The new arrival stood opposite me over the freshly murdered corpse. He glanced down and said,
"It looks like the Pancration started early this year."
Xenares said,
"None of your wit, please, Marcos. You can see this is a crisis."
The man Xenares had named Marcos was slightly taller than me, which meant neither tall nor short. He stood with a straight back, his face by torchlight pleasant but unremarkable. Our gazes met, and he smiled. His intelligent eyes were so deeply blue as to be almost black.
"We seem to have a problem here," he said to me,
as if he'd walked into a room where someone had spilled the wine. I didn't know who this Marcos was, but Xenares had called for him, and that made him an enemy. For that matter, I didn't know who Xenares was, except that he hated Athens, and a king of Sparta treated him with respect.
"There is another issue," said King Pleistarchus. "It's important to determine whether Arachos died fighting."
"Why do you care?" Pericles said. "It doesn't make him any less murdered."
"It is the custom of our people. If my fellow Spartan died in combat, then he is entitled to a headstone with his name upon it, so he will be remembered. But if he died without a fight, then his name is to be forgotten."
I said, "He was beaten, as you see. But there are signs of a long struggle. Look at these bruises, here, and here, and here." I touched different places on Arachos's arms and neck. "All we have to do is look for a man who's been in a fight," Marcos said.
"Of course there are signs of a struggle on him. He's a Pancratist. He's been doing nothing but practice fighting for the last 10 months."
"Oh, yes, of course." I had no choice but to admit it. Marcos was right and looked alert, while I had just made myself look like an idiot in front of these men.
"The same will go for Timodemus and every other contestant," Marcos continued. "There's no point searching for evidence of a fight on any of our suspects."
"What about looking for recent fresh bruises?"
a voice in the darkness asked.
"Was there anyone who didn't train this morning?"
Marcos asked reasonably. That was true. Why, even Timodemus, who had been thrown out of the contest, had picked a fight this morning, with me. I wiped my hands, though there was very little blood on them. The wounds of Arakos had not bled much and were already quite dry, but there was another problem. I've touched a dead body. I'm ritually unclean. Is there seawater?
Exelon, the chief judge, said, "The water of the Cladius is considered cleansing. You can wash on the way back to camp."
During this conversation, the other 9 judges of the games had trickled into the clearing, in varying states of wakefulness, and had been apprised of what had happened. Now, the chief judge turned to them, and they muttered together for an interminable time, while some of the most powerful men in Hellas waited in silence.
"Here is our judgment," said the chief judge, turning back to the main group. "The evidence against Timodemus, son of Timonus, is strong. For the murder of Arakos he is to be imprisoned in one of the ancient disused buildings, and after the closing ceremony he is to be tied hand and foot and thrown to his death from Mount Typaeum."
Mount Typaeum is a place of high cliffs along the road from Elis. To be thrown from it is the punishment reserved for women who sneak into the games. It is a particularly shameful death. Pericles turned to the judges and said, in a voice trained to oratory,
"This is not according to the law, which states there may be no executions during the truce."
"That is so," the chief judge said. "But this is day 1, and the sacred games end on day 5. Soon thereafter, the truce ends, when the Hellenes have had enough time to return to their homes. We'll give ourselves dispensation to act early, while everyone's still here to witness the consequences for sacrilege."
Pericles said,
"The men who compete in the Pancration are issued a blanket pardon for murder. This is the law."
Xenares spoke up.
"The law provides immunity if one athlete kills another during the competition."
Pericles opened his mouth to protest, but the chief judge held up his hand.
"Wait, I've not finished. The Athenians raise seeds of doubt regarding the guilt of Timodemus. Perhaps they will grow to bear fruit. Perhaps not. The Athenians may nominate a man to investigate this crime and, if they can, clear the name of their athlete. They have until the end of the games to prove Timodemus innocent."
4 days is not enough time,"
Pericles said.
"It's all the time you have," the chief judge said without sympathy. "After that, the people return to their own cities, and every witness and any suspects will be gone."
Pericles could only nod at the truth of that. Xenares scoffed.
"Such an investigation can have only one outcome. Of course the Athenians will whitewash their own man."
"You're right, Xenares."
Pleistarchus turned to the chief judge.
"Xenares, who is an ephor of Sparta, makes a good point. Sparta cannot accept this."
I wondered if the chief judge would threaten Pleistarchus the way he had Pericles, but instead he held up his hand in a placating gesture and turned back to his fellow judges. They conferred once more in low voices. I strained to hear what they said, but to no avail, until Exelon, the chief judge, announced,
"We, the judges of the games, will appoint a 3rd city to investigate this crime."
Pericles and Pleistarchus both snorted at that.
every important city in Hellas is either for Athens or against her, or allied with Sparta, or allied against," Pericles exclaimed.
Pleistarchus nodded.
"For once I must agree with Pericles. There are no neutral cities of any importance. Moreover, if you appoint some minor city to oversee the investigation, the Athenians will immediately put pressure on them. The Athenians will offer generous trade agreements to save their man, or threaten to impose extra import taxes on the city's merchant ships if they find against. That's the way of the Athenians, to cheat with their money."
I nodded to myself. Yes, that was exactly what Pericles would do.
Pericles said, face to face with Pleistarchus,
"And I suppose if the judges selected a minor city, you Spartans wouldn't threaten to attack them if they don't see things your way. The only cities free from Spartan bullying are the powerful ones, or the ones far from Sparta on the islands in the Aegean Sea. The judges must select one of them to investigate."
Pleistarchus objected.
"That's no good. They're all pro-Athenian."
"Because we protect them from the Persians," said Pericles. "While you, Spartans, refuse to venture so far from your homes."
"You have the ships. We don't," said Pleistarchus.
"I don't recall Athens whining so much when you needed us to defeat the Persians for you. If you protect the islands with your ships, it's because we protected you on land with our army."
"We fought the Persians together," said Pericles.
"And so did every other Hellene city. There was nothing special about Sparta."
"Except that without us, you would certainly have been conquered. My father died in that war, Athenian."
"So did many fathers."
"Enough! Silence, both of you."
The chief judge looked from Pericles to Pleistarchus, scowling.
"This squabble between the Athenians and Spartans is irrelevant. You will wait while the judges confer again."
The chief judge and his fellow judges stepped apart and spoke in low tones to one another in the semi-darkness. The rest of us waited in silence. Pericles caught my eye. As usual, I had no idea what he thought. Pericles could hide his true thoughts as easily as most men hide their dagger. What Pericles saw in me, I don't know, but what I felt was confusion for the contradictory evidence and fear for my friend Timodemus. The chief judge returned. He stamped his staff to get our attention.
"This is our final judgment. Athens and Sparta both speak truth. There is no city to investigate this crime that is beyond the influence of either one of you. Therefore, here is our decision. Let the Spartans assign their own investigator. Let the Athenians, too, have their own man investigate the crime. The Spartan and the Athenian shall see the same evidence and hear the same witnesses. Both will swear before Zeus Hercules to show no prejudice to their own city, to accept no bribes, and to do their best to discover the truth. Both will swear the oath of the Olympic contestants at first light on the steps of the Bouleterion." Pericles nodded with visible reluctance. Pleistarchus considered for a moment. Xenares, the ephor, grabbed the arm of his king. There was furious whispering between them. Xenares was obviously unhappy and wouldn't let go. Pleistarchus shook him off. The king of Sparta nodded agreement to the judges.
the chief judge said.
Name your men.
Xenares the Ephor spoke for Sparta. He said,
Spartan.